Joining us today on the show is a man that we love to get on board and talk all things South American football with. He is just the man with the largest amount of knowledge. I wondered what you thought I was going to say. The largest amount of South American footballing knowledge that we have ever known on this show. Of course, he is the BBC's very own Mr. Tim Vickery, joining us from South America, down in Brazil. Tim, how are you today, mate? It's a pleasure to have you back on the show.
Yeah, very, very well. And we've got lots and lots to talk about. So without further ado, let's get the ball rolling.
I hope that wasn't any sort of Freddie Adu pun for the American listeners. That's for sure there, Tim. Tim, let's kick straight off with the action that's coming up this weekend. Let's talk about this Confederations Cup. How important, we've spoken about how important these friendly games are for Brazil's World Cup preparation, but a competitive tournament for football, are they treating it as seriously as I'm expecting them to?
Yes, they are. And these are their only competitive games in the run-up to the World Cup. And their only competitive games since the Copa America 3 years ago, or 2 years ago now, 3 years before the World Cup. So this is absolutely vital for Brazil. This month of June is where Luis Felipe Scolari wants to get together with his players, to come out with his team and his tactical approach more or less defined for the World Cup. And also, absolutely crucially, perhaps the most important element of the Confederations Cup, he wants to come out with the Brazilian public fully behind the team. And I was at an event a couple of days ago where the clock was unveiled, a year to go to the World Cup. And Pelé there, he made a special appeal to Brazilians, don't boo your own team. Now, I know there's a lot of hysteria accompanying England, but can you imagine England having to wheel out Bobby Charlton to say, you know, don't boo the England team? It shows the difficulty of playing in front of Brazilian crowds. They can be a very, very tough crowd to play in front of. And there's always that danger that for Brazil, home advantage could become home disadvantage. So this is where Brazil start to win over their own public and ease their own passage towards winning the World Cup on home ground.
Is this something that's traditionally ingrained in the Brazilian football fan, that they just get frustrated by the Brazilian national team? Or is this something that's come about, especially with the fall that we've seen maybe in international football, especially with the drop in the FIFA rankings that Brazil have had recently?
No, it's always been there. And I had the privilege to know some of the players and the coach from the 1950 side who lost on home ground in that final game against Uruguay. It just shows you how cruel the World Cup can be, any cup competition. And Brazil were winning their games 6-0, 6-1. Didn't even play a bad game against Uruguay. Didn't really play a bad half, but just had a bad few minutes, and that was enough for Uruguay to win the game 2-1. Those Brazilian players, great, great players, who really put their country's football on the map, in their own country would be considered losers. And one of them, I remember Jair, great inside forward, one of the big helpers for the young Pelé when he first got into the Santos side. Jair saying, look, where you come from, you can lose, and it's taken with respect. But, you know, where we come from, we lose and people are capable of coming at you with a knife. So that's part of the traditional makeup of Brazilian football. In fact, a kind of legend exists that in order to win the World Cup, Brazil first have to be booed by their own crowd. Because usually, historically, the times that they've won it are the times when they've gone into the competition with the crowd not really sure about them. And the times when they've kind of swanned in on high heels with everyone thinking they're going to win are the times when perhaps they've fallen on their backsides. So it is a very, very difficult crowd to play in front of. And obviously that is exacerbated by the time of transition that they're having over recent years. They're a little bit between generations at the moment, aren't they? You know, with the generation of Kaká and Ronaldinho on the way down, so much so that neither have been called up for the Confederations Cup. The generation of Neymar and Oscar still on the way up. We don't know how good they're going to be. So they just beat France on Sunday, and that was the first time that, in their own estimation, they've beaten their top-ranking opponent since 2009. So, yes, the recent troubles and the current transition phase have added to the fans' displeasure with their own team, but also it's a historical trait of a very, very demanding football public.
I don't want to go back to it too much, especially because I hate going back because it sounds like we're going back for the sake of English football, but that draw against England in the Maracanã recently, how was that treated in Brazil? Because England aren't considered that a top national side really anymore, and it was an England side that's been on the rocks recently. Brazil would have had high hopes of pipping them, especially in the Maracanã.
you'd be surprised, actually, the respect that they give England over here. I tend to view that they probably give the England national team more respect than we deserve. It was a very, very interesting game, I think, from the point of view of the balance that Scolari, the coach, is looking for from his team. Now, he took over, and his first game was at Wembley at the start of the year, and he brought back the centre forward, and he went with a 4-2-3-1. And we saw in that game at Wembley that his two, who were Paulinho and Ramirez, were continually played out of the game by Jack Wiltshire. So that straight away, that was a problem for Scolari, who's a little bit of a safety-first coach. He wants his clean sheet. But ever since, he's been struggling for a balance there of that midfield two in his 4-2-3-1. And one of the reasons that Ramirez has not been called up is that I don't think Scolari trusts him to be one of those two. He likes his lung power, perhaps, but he doesn't really trust his positional play. So the first half against England, he went with Luis Gustavo of Bayern Munich holding alongside Paulinho, who had to rein in his natural, almost Frank Lampard-esque tendency to burst through and get into the opposing penalty area. Now, the first half, Brazil absolutely dominated, perhaps without creating that much. They had a lot of chances, but a lot of the, like, for the statistics chances. But they did really have a stranglehold on that first half. Seeing how negative England had been first half, at half time, Scolari decided to risk it a little bit. He took off his holding midfielder, brought on Hernanes, much more of a playmaker, and he went for it. He took the risk, and it got him two goals. Two goals from his midfielders. I know the first one was from the centre forward Freire, but that was a shot from Hernanes that came back off the crossbar. Then Paulinho at the end of the game got him his equaliser. So he got two goals there, but he also conceded two goals. Both goals happening in that space in front of the centre backs. So again, after that game, Scolari not happy with his midfield balance in that second half. So what's happened there, I think, as a result of the England game, is we will definitely have a sitter, a holding midfielder. Luis Gustavo played there against France. He actually made the first goal, the vital first goal. I think that has established him as, for the time being, Brazil's holding midfielder. So that England game was a very, very important part of Brazil's development as Scolari tries to get a balance there for his midfield. I think it's going to be safety first. It's going to be caution first with those two central midfielders. He'll only free Paulinho to bomb forward into the box if he's really needing a goal.
Tim, you mentioned earlier on in the chat that Kaká and Ronaldinho hadn't been put into this Brazil side. It was the older guys that were being maybe pushed out slightly by Scolari. Were you surprised, especially about Kaká not being involved in this side? Because there was so much talk about him and Neymar's relationship on the international stage with each other, how they were playing well together, enjoying each other's company. And a really positive impact Kaká was being on Neymar's development at the international game. Would he not be useful, considering he played well when he played for Madrid this year, to bring into this Brazil side? Were you a little surprised by it?
Interesting perspective here, because the absence of Ronaldinho was far more news, bombshell, than the absence of Kaká. And Scolari brought Kaká in for a game, wasn't impressed at all with what he saw. I think that Kaká, not 100% physically, and without that little bit of acceleration to take him away from his marker, thought that he was perhaps a little bit too easy to mark. So I wasn't surprised with Kaká. But the bombshell, I think, was Ronaldinho, because he's been in such sparkling club form. But I understand where Scolari's coming from with that one, because every time he stepped up with the national team, he looks a lot like a passenger. And also, knowing the way that Scolari thinks, in that line, that 4-2-3-1, he wants the central fella in that line of three to do more marking than Ronaldinho was doing. And that's the position that, since the absence of Ronaldinho and since the absence of Kaká, that's now Neymar's position. Neymar has claimed the number 10 shirt. He's always been the 11 for Brazil. He's now claimed the number 10 shirt. So it's a lot of responsibility to put on Neymar. It's going to be make or break for Neymar next year in the World Cup, assuming that things stay that way. But one of the reasons I think that Scolari has gone with him is not only Neymar's attacking ability, but also the fact that he gets in and puts a foot in, as does Oscar. So, Scolari is very much thinking that he wants solidity from his team. He wants not to concede goals, then in the hope that a little bit of individual brilliance from his players can win him the game.
Who's considered the favourite then for this Confederations Cup before we move on to a little bit of World Cup qualifying, Tim? Who out of all these sides in it? It's a great list of sides that we've got in competing this year. Who's the favourite?
Well, I think everyone wants a Brazil versus Spain match, whether it comes in the semi-final or whether it comes in a final. I think we just want the match. You know, they've found bizarre ways of avoiding each other in recent tournaments, and there'll be some edge in that match. Scolari, he didn't include Spain amongst his World Cup favourites. I don't think he rates them that much. You know, despite all their triumphs, all of his passing the ball around, I don't think he holds with that very much. So it would be great to see a Brazil-Spain game. I think for this Confederations Cup, I think Brazil probably go in as favourites just because it means more to them than anyone else. And for some of the other sides, it's reconnaissance more than anything else. For Brazil, it can't be that. It's not reconnaissance. For Brazil, it's serious. So I think Brazil go into this as favourites. It'll be interesting to see how they cope with the pressure of being favourites. But as you say, we've got an interesting lineup. And Mexico's a side to watch. I mean, I think Mexico will enjoy the fact that it's different from the CONCACAF World Cup qualifiers, where Mexico always have the responsibility for taking the game. They've struggled a bit for goals, haven't they, in your qualifying region there. Mexico, without that responsibility, I think they might enjoy themselves. Uruguay, perhaps they've just rediscovered their mojo, and such a difficult tournament team, especially with that heritage of having won the World Cup when it was last played here in Brazil in 1950. And wouldn't it be event if we had... No, just after, in 1950, Uruguay beat Brazil in the final in the newly built Maracanã. If we were to have a final on June the 30th, Brazil against Uruguay in the newly rebuilt Maracanã, wouldn't that be an event? I'm sure we're going to get something that, even though it is a test event and a reconnaissance event for many, I think we'll still have a few things to remember from these 2 weeks.
Yeah, the footballing world and the footballing gods, if you will, have a habit of throwing up these sorts of occasions like that. Tim, in World Cup qualifying for Brazil 2014 in South America, Uruguay have found the golden touch once again, got that win against Venezuela just a few days ago, thanks to a Cavani goal. It's been all over the place. I still can't pick who is going to be my teams going through in this CONMEBOL qualification. We've only got, I think, 3 games left for each side in this tournament now, in the qualification rounds. How is this playing out to you? Because I still can't pick anybody to set on for going through, apart from maybe the Argies.
Well, I think we've got 4 more or less sorted out. I mean, Argentina are there, I think. I think 26 points they've got. I think that'll be enough. I reckon 25 points might be enough to get you through, which means Colombia are very close. Chile were the big winners of these 2 games. They were the only side to win their 2 games, and they've now got themselves in that top 4 with a 5-point cushion. And Ecuador, the only thing Ecuador have to worry about, I think, is they've only got 1 home game left. They've got 4 games still to play, only 1 at home. And they don't pick up too many away points, although one of their trips is to Bolivia, where many sides, or most sides, really dread the extreme altitude of La Paz. It's not so onerous for Ecuador. So it looks to me as if Argentina are there already. Colombia have got a foot and a half there. And Chile and Ecuador are not far off. But we've got a battle royale building up for 5th place, the playoff slot. And that's important. You know, it's not a consolation prize, that 5th slot. Let's remember that last time round, Uruguay came 5th in South America and then came 4th in the world. They reached the World Cup semi-finals. So the side that finishes 5th, don't rule them out from doing something in Brazil next year. And we've got a terrific battle coming up. And September really, really highlights this battle for 5th place, because we've got Uruguay and Venezuela level on points, with Uruguay having a game in hand. And we've got Peru 2 points behind. Peru also with a game in hand on Venezuela. And in September, Peru first are at home to Uruguay, and then Peru are away to Venezuela, while Uruguay host Colombia. So difficult games and a real 3-way battle for that 5th place. And I think that's probably the most interesting thing we're going to get now in the last 4 rounds of this marathon competition. Who's going to come 5th? And it usually comes down to the last ball being kicked in the last round. And Uruguay kind of consider the thing that 5th place there is by right. They've claimed it in the last 3 campaigns, sometimes by the narrowest of margins. But first, they've got to go to Peru in September, And Peru in Lima, dangerous opponents, especially when all their strikers are fit. They've got an interesting generation coming up. And so that's the big one now for Uruguay, away to Peru, September the 7th, I think that game will be. And the Confederations Cup for Uruguay is a kind of warm-up exercise for that match.
I mean, you look at some of the sides. Chile have got Ecuador and Colombia in those final four games. And Venezuela must be ecstatic to have Paraguay coming up, because at the bottom of the table, they've been almost the whipping boys of this World Cup qualification. How important could that game for Venezuela be, this game against Paraguay, just almost having a seemingly assured 3 points?
Well, yeah, although the Paraguayans can be perverse, but it is absolutely vital because that's their last game. And then the final round, because nine teams, Brazil obviously being absent as hosts, nine teams, it means that one side sits out per round. And the very, very last round, Venezuela sits out. And that's going to be an anxious, anxious wait. And if they haven't beaten Paraguay, perhaps not such an anxious wait, because their chances might well have evaporated. But it's going to go right down to the wire. And the usual practice is to stage the games that matter at exactly the same time, so no one has an advantage. The problem for Venezuela is that they're not in that last round, so the other teams will know exactly what they need to do in order to get past Venezuela. So perhaps it's a disadvantage for Venezuela to be sitting out that last round.
Tim, we saw a very dark cloud over some of the World Cup qualification games this week. Riot police involved, and Mascherano kicking the guy driving the medical buggy. I mean, it's not uncommon to see riot police, fan violence and whatnot in South American football. Is there any sort of worry, though, that this sort of attention on South American football leading into the World Cup is going to have a big negative impact on how it's viewed around the world and how kind of it's respected around the world?
Well, for the World Cup, it's a different kind of supporter. And I don't anticipate the problems that we have. And we've got huge problems in Argentina at the moment. Yet another fan killed, clashes on Monday, and visiting fans banned in Argentina at the moment. I don't expect anything too similar in the World Cup. Although Brazil at the moment, because it's hosting all of these mega events, it has a global visibility the like of which it's never had before. The world is watching, and stories that things that happen in Brazil are being picked up all around the world in ways that have never happened before. I'm hoping this is going to have a positive effect, because crowd control, it's an area where Brazil and South America in general, but specifically Brazil because it's hosting these events, has an awful lot to learn. And mistakes and miscalculations and truculence with crowd control, the world will be watching. And my hope is this fact of global visibility will lead to improved practices in crowd control, because the sad lesson that we English learnt is that hooliganism is certainly not the only killer. You know, the sheer number of people together at a football stadium, sometimes we take those numbers for granted. You know, you get the population of an entire city fitting into the space of a stadium. The sheer quantity of people together in a reduced space in itself represents a threat to the safety of those people, especially if methods of crowd control are inadequate. So my hope is that these international events will leave a legacy in Brazil in terms of improved crowd control.
Tim, just one final question, if that's all right, before we let you go. I know we've taken up plenty of your time today. We can't not talk about Copa Libertadores. When we got into the knockout rounds, we saw the Brazilian club sides were looking so strong, and it was patched on arguably to have potentially an all-Brazilian final, or at least a pair of Brazilian sides in the semi-finals. We got down to the semi-final stage now, and only Atletico Mineiro remain, and only just after that penalty in last-second penalty save against Tijuana in the quarterfinals. Overall in Copa Libertadores, where are you going with these final four? Who has looked the strongest, in your opinion, throughout these knockout rounds?
Well, the story with the Brazilian clubs is an extraordinary one, because these days the financial gap which exists between them and the rest of the continent, even the big Argentine side, it's a huge, huge gap. But we didn't really see that on the field, did we? Grêmio, for example, invested a fortune, and the Grêmio squad is worth much, much more than their opponents. Olimpia, who of Paraguay, who eliminated Fluminense, Fluminense have one player. Olympia's entire wage bill wouldn't pay for one Fluminense star name. So a couple of conclusions that you can pull from that. And one, isn't it great that football is not just money? That money is not the only factor. It's a question of ideas as well. But the other is, I think that Brazilian football seriously has to look at, domestic Brazilian football seriously has to look at some of the things that it's doing. And a goal which I've tried to highlight on my appearances on Brazilian TV is the one from Santa Fe of Colombia that eliminated Grêmio, where Santa Fe are at home, they're 11 minutes away from elimination. But it's a wonderful goal that they score. They're an experienced side, well coached, a very impressive coach, I think, Wilson Gutierrez. And no panic, just with 11 minutes to go. Observing the fundamentals of football. If you're in the zone of elaboration, forget the goal and look for a teammate. And if you keep looking for a teammate, the goal will appear. And so they move the ball about very patiently, and then suddenly they see the opportunity, and then you get the change of rhythm, quick 1-2 and a goal. A wonderful goal. And Brazilian TV showed the game. And afterwards, they wanted to highlight, well, perhaps there was a player who was 10 centimetres offside during that move. And I thought that was entirely the wrong conclusion to draw. You should have been examining the concepts of football used in that goal. Because so often with the Brazilian teams now, and there's this demand for the team to be warriors. And the players are being sent out full of warrior spirit, and that's what everyone wants to see. And I would rather see some football and some concepts of football. So I think Brazilian football needs to have a look at itself, because it doesn't have money or lack of money as an excuse anymore. In fact, money is a huge advantage when it comes to these South American club competitions. Well, who have we got left? We've got Newell's of Argentina and Atletico of Brazil. And Atletico, although they really showed some nerves against Tijuana and were very, very lucky to go through, not only with a penalty, but I thought on the balance of the games, Tijuana deserved it. On their day, Atletico can still play some lovely stuff with Ronald. That link-up between Ronaldinho and Bernard is a lovely link-up. An attractive side to watch, as are Newell's. Newell's, perhaps their two games with Boca Juniors were something of a disappointment, although the drama of the penalty shootout was exceptional, 13 shots each. There, and so Newell's Atletico is the game that will grab global attention. It's Argentina against Brazil. It's two certainly on paper attractive sides. The other one, Olimpia and Santa Fe. Santa Fe can play a little bit, as we were talking earlier on. Olimpia have variations, and they have the Paraguayan, the famous Paraguayan resilience. They can shut up shot if they need to. They can really go for goals if they need to. But as a fan of stroking the ball around the midfield, I would love to see Santa Fe get through, because I enjoy what they're doing very much. But plenty of drama and hopefully some good football to look out for when the Libertadores resumes after the Confederations Cup.
And I think we've all absolutely loved watching and staying in tune with the Copa Libertadores this year. And Tim, we've all absolutely loved having you on board with us throughout this season. And we look forward to catching up with you later on this summer as we continue to look into the Brazilian Serie A and, of course, the final of the Copa Libertadores and the semi-finals coming up as well. It's been an absolute pleasure today, mate, as always. Thank you so much for joining us, Tim.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Tim Vickery there joining us here on World Football Daily to talk all things South American football and the Confederations Cup coming up tomorrow. Tim saying how important this Brazilian side is taking it. He's told us so many times, Tim, how...